you so much for your introduction and for the invitation to come here. But first, I have to beg your pardon because what I'm going to present to you is not an elaborated paper, but merely a sketch and some scattered thoughts. My plan was to investigate music histories that are used in present textbooks, for example, textbooks for schools, or music histories that are used for introducing students to music history, and eventually to have a look at the course plans of German universities and to see how they teach music history there. But the source material wasn't valid enough to investigate this, and so I'm going back to a different question, and this derives from Friedrich Blume, the editor of the first edition of Die Musik in Geschichte und Gegenwart, who once wrote that every generation has to write its own music history. And what I'm doing now is not to write my own music history, but to think about where my music history, my knowledge of music history comes from, and to present an observation to you that has to do with some certain composers that are not reflected in music history, and to wonder why this may have happened. And if I'm talking about my own generation and my contribution to the knowledge of music history, I cannot neglect that I'm very influenced by the concept of cultural studies, as it may be part of my scholarly generation in Germany at all. To make this a bit more precise, then I have to say that music history, history in general, or music history, it doesn't matter in this case, seen under the impact of cultural studies, includes the negotiation of culture, power, and identity, buzzwords, and sometimes quoted as the magic triangle of cultural studies. So history includes this negotiation. History includes to search for certain cultural practices of music, and we should also bear in mind that there are cultural practices of musicology. This relates, for example, to teaching or to contributing to textbooks on music history. And music history thus also includes making contributors and contributions visible. It's a process of decanonization, and we had some papers already, and I think especially Martin, your paper will be on this topic right after the coffee break. History includes a lot of smaller aspects that are going to be made visible in this respect. And therefore, music history promotes, and we can look at our conference program and see this happens here, music history promotes case studies rather than the music history in general, and it promotes rethinkings. And I'm quoting here the famous book of Cook and Everest, Rethinking Music. We had a paper on rethinking music history, and this process is going on and on. And this all reflects that we have a loss of grand narratives in our postmodern scholarly society, and our knowledge has increased that much that we have to say we are not able to tell any story of music history that is something different than case studies or rethinkings. So it's maybe it's a bit too harsh to form the, to put this, but just to stress the point a little. And when I'm thinking about my own approach to music history, I have to admit that for two or three terms, I came to study with Karl Dahlhaus. He has been mentioned several times here. And of course, in the beginning of my study in musicology, I was influenced by his view and by the view that goes back to Theodor Adorno, which was in close relation to, who was in close relation to Karl Dahlhaus. In his most influential Philosophy of Modern Music, German philosopher Theodor Adorno, to a wide extent influenced by Hegelian thinking and not far from Marxism, postulates a view of musical progress that is entirely based upon teleological thinking. In his opinion, for example, the development of compositional techniques and musical material proceeds in logical succession from tonality to atonality, 12-tone music, and serialism, accompanied by ever-advancing complexity. Composers whose music does not fit to this scheme are either ignored or strictly devaluated. In this respect, one starting point of my considerations has been the case of Austrian composer Joseph Matthias Hauer. Hauer, born 1883 in Vienna, has developed a method for composing with the entire chromatic scale some 5 years before Arnold Schönberg. Hauer's method, in contrast to Schönberg's, comprises the organization of the chromatic scale in sets of so-called tropes. According to Hauer, there are 44 tropes, and each trope consists of two related hexachords with a distinct arrangement of intervals. A pair of hexachords with minor seconds only, leading to a chromatic scale in the first, which you can see here, through different metamorphoses to a pair of hexachords with major seconds only, leading to two shifted whole tone scales in both of the hexachords in the 44th trope, which you can see right in the bottom. Practical composition with these tropes implies to choose a trope and build a 12-tone row by freely ordering the six notes from the first, then the six notes from the second hexachord. Tropes, therefore, are in a way substitutes for the keys as they rule the relation of the tones within the scale. This method leads to a music that is described in current publications as athematic, in a way, going back to fascination of construction rather than a need for expression, like it is crucial to Schönberg. The method of construction, I tried to make this visible in the lines you see the tropes, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth tropes. And we see that we have minor seconds and the left hexachord first changed to a major second in the last interval of the trope, which goes right down here. And we see what happens here. And this is perfect harmony within this construction. And this is what Hauer's method is about. Adorno, however, reflects Hauer's method in relation to Schönberg's. And I beg your pardon that I have to quote Adorno in German. There is a translation into English, but I did not manage to get access to the entire English translation right in time. So this is just the the main point that's translated into the English in the last paragraph. Quote, man darf die Zwölftontechnik nicht als eine Kompositionstechnik, etwa wie die des Impressionismus, missverstehen. Alle Versuche, sie als solche zu benutzen, führen ins Absurde. Eher ist sie einer Anordnung der Farben auf der Palette zu vergleichen, als dem Malen des Bildes. Das Komponieren beginnt in Wahrheit erst, wenn die Zwölftondisposition fertig ist. Daher hat denn auch diese das Komponieren nicht leichter, sondern schwerer gemacht. Sie verlangt, dass jedes Stück, sei es der einzelne Satz, sei es auch ein ganzes mehrsätziges Werk, aus einer Grundgestalt oder Reihe abgeleitet werde. Ein solches Verfahren hat unabhängig von Schönberg der österreichische Komponist Hauer ausgebildet und die Resultate sind von ödester Dürftigkeit. The Austrian composer Josef Hauer developed such a procedure independently of Schönberg. The results were of most barren meagerness. And I have a listening example, just 1 minute from Hauer's Small Piano Pieces, Opus 25. And so please look forward to some barren meagerness. Written in German language, ignore Hauer's contribution to the development of 12-tone composition, since Adorno's philosophy mainly affected the way of how new music is placed in writing, in the writing of music history in the western part of post-war Germany. According to Adorno, music is valued by its respective modernity and therefore by its complexity. Already in his early essays for the Vienna-based journal Anbruch, Adorno claimed that musical progress is proportional to the composer's ability to constructively deal with the possibilities and limitations contained within what Adorno called the musical material. For Adorno, 12-tone serialism constitutes a decisive, historically developed method of composition. The objective validity of the composition, according to Adorno, rests with neither the composer's genius nor the work's conformity with prior standards, but with the way in which the work coherently expresses the dialectic of the material. In this sense, the contemporary absence of composers of the status of Bach or Beethoven is not the sign of musical regression. Instead, new music is to be credited with laying bare aspects of the musical material previously repressed. The musical material's liberation from number, the harmonic series, and tonal harmony. Thus, historical progress is only achieved by the composer who submits to the work and seemingly does not undertake anything active except to follow where it leads. Because historical experience and social relations are embedded within this musical material, it is to the analysis of such material that the critic must turn. In the face of this radical liberation of the musical material, Adorno came to criticize those who, like Stravinsky, withdrew from this freedom by tasking recourse to forms of the past as well as those who, like Hauer, seemingly turned 12-tone composition into a technique which dictated the rules of composition. Adorno's influence in the western part of post-war Germany is obvious. Upon his return after having lived in exile during the Nazi period in Germany, Adorno helped shape the political culture of western Germany. Until his death in 1969, 20 years after his return, Adorno contributed to the intellectual foundations of the Federal Republic as a professor at Frankfurt University, critic of the vogue enjoyed by Heideggerian philosophy, partisan of critical sociology, and teacher of music at the Darmstadt International Summer Courses for New Music. Musicologists like Karl Dahlhaus were strongly influenced by Adorno, and therefore, by no surprise, music history writing does not reflect phenomenons like Hauer's arithmetic compositions at all. In the same way, more recent developments in musical composition are valued skeptically. Adorno saw the culture industry as an arena in which critical tendencies or potentialities were eliminated. He argued that the culture industry, which produced and circulated cultural commodities through the mass media, manipulated the population. Popular culture was identified as a reason why people become passive. The easy pleasures available through consumption of popular culture made people docile and content, no matter how terrible their economic circumstances. To a certain extent, this also applies to postmodern music. When speaking about postmodernism in music, I do not focus on a distinct musical style. Jonathan Kramer posits the idea that postmodernism, including musical postmodernism, is less a surface style or historical period than an attitude. Kramer enumerates 16 characteristics of postmodern music, by which I mean music that is understood in a postmodern manner or that calls forth postmodern listening strategies or that provides postmodern listening experiences or that exhibits postmodern compositional practices. According to Kramer, postmodern music, first, is not simply a repudiation of modernism or its continuation, but has aspects of both a break and an extension. Fourth, I skipped some of the points which are not so important to me at present. Postmodern music, four, challenges barriers between high and low styles. Eight, considers music not as autonomous, but as relevant to cultural, social, and political context. 15, presents multiple meanings and multiple temporalities. And finally, 16, locates meaning and even structure in listeners more than in scores, performances, or composers. Some of these points stand in total opposition to Adorno's view that is entirely based on the concept of analysis that is immanent to the work being analyzed. In his late Aesthetic Theory, written in the time of postmodernity in Germany, Adorno points out that only an immanent view reflects the distinctive features of artistic experience. And I quote in German first, "Der Begriff künstlerischer Erfahrung, an den Ästhetik übergeht und der durch das Desiderat zu verstehen unversöhnlich mit dem Positivismus ist, koinzidiert indessen keineswegs mit dem gängigen der werkimmanenten Analyse. Diese, der künstlerischen Erfahrung gegen die Philologie selbstverständlich, markiert fraglos in der Wissenschaft einen entscheidenden Fortschritt. Zweige der Kunstwissenschaft, wie der mit der Musik akademisch befasste, erwachten erst dann aus ihrer pharisäischen Lethargie, wenn sie jene Methode, also die der werkimmanenten Analyse, nachholten, anstatt mit allem sich abzugeben, außer mit Strukturfragen der Kunstwerke." The English translation, the translator's acknowledgement is wonderful at the end. Various branches of art scholarship, such as the academic study of music, only awoke from their pharisaical lethargy when they caught up with this method of work immanent analysis, rather than by busying themselves with everything except what concerns the structure of artworks. If postmodern music, however, is considered not as autonomous, but as relevant to different other aspects, and as related to structures that are located in performances rather than in the scores, it seems clear that immanent analysis does not gain qualified insights into the music. And to conclude, I wanted to present to you some of the textbooks of German music history, and Karl Dahlhaus in the western part, and his contemporary Georg Knebler in the eastern part. Both books appeared in print 1977, and both gained different results. Karl Dahlhaus promoted a music history that appeared in print as Europäische Musikgeschichte, European History of Music. And this music history, which I do not have in cover here, is quite popular in the use in German universities to teach music history in the earlier stages of the curriculum. And my point was to look for references to the music of Arvo Pärt and to the music of Alfred Schnittke. Arvo Pärt, with his Tintinnabuli steel, with his later Tintinnabuli steel, could be, or to start from a different point, my point is not to contrast modern music and postmodern music as entities, but I'm sure that composers like Pärt and Schnittke do not fit into the scheme of modern music. So maybe they're postmodern componists, but that's not so important to me. They do not fit into the scheme of modern music, and that's the main point. Arvo Pärt, with his modern simplicity, as it could be called sometimes, and Alfred Schnittke with his polystylistic style, which is some of the aspects Kramer points out. And to look for this music in the European history of music that's promoted by Karl Dahlhaus does not give any results. Pärt and Schnittke do not occur in this music history. They are not even cited. In the case of Knebler, things are a little more difficult because there is no correspondent music history in Eastern Germany. Knebler himself wrote a music history of 19th century, and this is nothing to compare. It's nothing to compare. But two newer textbooks give some more interesting results. In the left hand you see the book Neue Ohren für Neue Musik by Konstantin Floros. Konstantin Floros is a German musicologist of Greek birth who's nearly of the same age as Dahlhaus was, as Dahlhaus was today. Dahlhaus was born in 1928. Floros is born 1930, and this book does something that I gave a hint to in the first slide. Floros presents case studies of certain composers, case studies of certain styles, and case studies of certain works. And he does have two chapters out of 16 that are devoted to one Arvo Pärt and one Alfred Schnittke. So Floros gives worthful hints to discover new music with new ears for new music, is the translation of the title. The book that you should see on the right-hand side, Neue Musik, eine kritische Bilanz, by Marcel Doberstein, seems interesting to me because Doberstein is as old as I am. He's born 1964, and his critical investigation of new music and 100 years of errors presents a critical view on the impact of Adorno, the same as I do. But what Doberstein concludes is that new music should be neglected at all. He's not interested in Arvo Pärt, he's not interested in Schnittke, he is not even interested in Schönberg. Music history comes to an end with, let's say, Gustav Mahler. And this is a view that has been published in 2007. And the book sells quite good. So, these were some of my scattered thoughts. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for this very interesting paper. And I think we have maybe 5 minutes for discussion, and maybe we can begin a little bit later, continue a little bit later after coffee break. What's the thing? Yeah. 5 minutes for discussion. Yeah, what's the thing?
Yes, thank you for the presentation. I agree perfectly with you. I mean, when I left Germany, I was surprised how superficial the Adorno reception is abroad. If you come from Germany, you can imagine how little it is known, actually, it's, for instance, in Northern Europe. And I think that's the reason. You took Howard as an example, but you can take one example which is geographically a little bit closer to us. For instance, Adorno's greatest country. His two infamous articles where you can just see that he needs some kind of punch bowl to hit, just to have some kind of anti-example. And Sibelius did even not fit in his model, and Sibelius does not play a really big role in German music history writing, as he does in Anglo-American writing, where he's regarded to be a contributor to a symphonic genre of first rank. And that happened in Germany not until very recently, I would say, that he has been acknowledged. I don't know if that's really Adorno's fault. Maybe, I guess there's something in that. So I would say it's time to revise music history.
Yeah, you're entirely right. But the case of Sibelius seems to be a bit more difficult to me, because there is the other story of Sibelius and the Nazi regime, and the promotion of his music by the Nazis. So this, besides Adorno, makes this case a little difficult.
It's one thing, and the other thing is that he also dismisses or discusses English music writing. So he says, here in Britain, he's quite popular, that will never happen in Germany. In brackets, Germany is much higher than that. Only one thing, I think you are wrong, because you're writing that Adorno had no impact on GDR musicology. He had, I think, in the 80s, very fine state, Christian Garden and Gavinic were resetting his writings quite intensively.
Yeah.
See the deep impact of the texts.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I know the most recent studies of Nina Nöske and Matthias Tischer, and of course you're right, things are a little more complicated with Adorno and the GDR.
Well, it's just very tiny, really. I'm curious to know what the reception of the Doberstein book was in Germany, because there was a kind of an equivalent book that came out in America, I think, called, it was written by American theorist William Thompson, called Schoenberg's Error. And it seemed to be presenting pretty much the same kind of line. A mistake was made at this point, and everything that flowed from that mistake was, and that book was totally crucified, I mean, in the whole Anglo-American world. So I'm just wondering how the Dobrostein fared in critical reception.
As far as I know, there have been no reviews in the major musicological magazines, but maybe Martin.
Yeah, there was a hidden review in the Musikforschung by Thomas Kabisch. And Thomas Kabisch wrote an excellent essay on this book, and he compared it, if I remembered right, he compared it a little bit with Don Quixote and the combat against the windmills, and in several points. And new music is bad. Why I think new music is bad, and so he was able to demonstrate how stupid the argumentation was. It was very convincing, and it was very entertaining to her. But please read it.
Like a pillow note, yeah.
Just a little remark on this thing concerning Sibelius and Adorno. So you mentioned the role of the Nazis and the fact that they promoted Sibelius with such eagerness. But then there's this detail. It seems that Adorno reacted to the book by a very eager student, by Sibelius Bengtsson. His book, which was really a simple defense of Sibelius, it was translated into English, Sibelius Up Close Up. And so very soon after, Adorno reacted.
Thank you.